discussion this evening. Song of Solomon, let's read from verse 1 in chapter 1, just to get into the book to start off. A Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine. Because of the savour of thy good ointments, thy name is as ointment poured forth, therefore do the virgins love thee. Draw me, we will run after thee. The king hath brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in thee. We will remember thy love more than wine. The upright love thee. I am black, but comely, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, as the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon. Look not upon me because I am black, because the sun hath looked upon me. My mother's children were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard have I not kept. Tell me, O thou whom my soul loveth, where thou feedest, where thou makest thy flock to rest at noon, for why should I be as one that turneth aside by the flocks of thy companions? If thou know not, O thou fairest among women, go thy way forth by the footsteps of the flock, and feed thy kids beside the shepherd's tents. And that will do for our introductory reading this evening. So really, all I want to do this evening is to give an introduction, a background to this particular book, The Song of Solomon. In so doing, of course, it would be very useful to know what the Jews thought of this particular book, because after all, they included the Song of Solomon in their Bible, in they considered to be the Word of God. And it would be interesting to discover how they regarded the Song of Solomon, particularly in the light of the fact that there were some of the reformers who later thought it shouldn't have a place in the canon of Scripture. Well, when the Jews looked at the Song of Solomon, they held it in the highest esteem. In fact, it's always been reverenced by them as a part of the oracles of God. They had no doubt of its validity and inspiration. And they reckoned that the Song of Solomon was amongst one of the holiest of books. In fact, in some of the rabbinical writings, they compare the Song of Solomon to the holiest of all, the holies of holies. I mean, that was the regard which they had for it. And not only did they regard it that way, but they used it as well. They used it in the Feast of Passover Unleavened Bread. And what they did was they used to sing it, or read it rather, during that particular feast. Interesting that that should be so, because when you put that into context with today, it leads to the thought that it's only those who know Christ as the true Passover Lamb who can have any hope of understanding what this particular book is about. And the Jews regarded it to such an extent that they used it in their first feast. And into the second feast, I think it was the fourth day of the unleavened bread, that they used to use this particular song. Now, one thing is clear, and it's this, that the Jews would not have used this particular book in worship, in their worship, if they regarded it merely and purely as a human love story. They must have regarded it as something more than simply a literary art which demonstrated human love. The earliest Christians, in the earliest centuries of the church, when they talked about this particular book, and there are various writers who wrote about it in the early centuries, when they did so, they saw this book as symbolical of the relationship which exists between Christ, and it was taken by them to demonstrate the love of Christ for his church, and the love of Christ for the individual believer. And that's how the early church regarded it. Now, having said that, there are possibly four standpoints from which we may view the Song of Solomon. We might look at it from a dispensational standpoint. We might look at it from a redemptive standpoint. We might look at it from a spiritual standpoint. And we might look at it simply from a literary standpoint. So you have these four standpoints in which you might look at it. First of all, you can look at it in a dispensational way. And in doing that, what you would be doing is you would be looking at the Song of Solomon as it portrays the relationship between Jehovah and Israel. And in particular, the remnant of Israel. And there is a great point in that, because you must remember that in the Old Testament, as far as the Old Testament was concerned, the church was still a mystery, only to be revealed in the New Testament. And consequently, there must be some relationship which applied to those who read it in the day that it was read before the coming of the Lord Jesus. And that relationship between Israel and Jehovah is made clear in the prophets. For instance, you will find in the prophecy of Isaiah that there are several references to the relationship existing between Jehovah and Israel. The Lord is thy husband, says Jehovah. The same relationship is indicated in the prophecy of Jeremiah. And the same relationship is indicated very poignantly in the prophecy of Hosea, where you have a bride, a wife, who is the wife of, whose name is Gomer, and she's the wife of Hosea. And the relationship between Gomer and Hosea is used by God to portray the relationship which exists between him and Israel, and the unfaithfulness of Israel as wife to himself. And yet, in the book of Hosea, the love of God shines through, and ultimately, the wife who is unfaithful will be restored. And so you've got this relationship in the Old Testament. Now, if you really want to study that particular relationship, and it is a valid one, I suggest that you read a particular book, and I think you've got it on your desk there. Yes. Okay. If you lift it up, because that's a book entitled Rise Up, My Love. It's a quotation from the third chapter, and it's by my very good friend and colleague, Cyril Hocking. And that's a book which is very helpful from that standpoint. It's not an easy study to follow, but it certainly covers this particular standpoint. And you'll find the first half of the book valuable to looking at the flora and fauna and so on, which he does some detail of. But that is certainly a valid angle. Secondly, there is the redemptive, what I'm going to call the redemptive side of it, and that is the relationship between Christ and the church. And that is an approach which has been made by many writers in the past, particularly by early Brethren writers, who made this distinction, that made this relationship, rather, between Christ and the church. Thirdly, there is the spiritual application, and that is relationship between Christ and the individual believer. And that overlaps, as it must do, with the previous one, because the church consists of individual believers, so you have this overlap. And sometimes the passages in the Song of Solomon can apply directly to you and me. And so you have that picture as well. And lastly, of course, there's just that simple literary approach where you are looking at this song as the glorification of wedded love. Simple and sublime songs of human affection. There is that particular approach which I don't think we're going to really be concerned with, because I feel that the Song of Solomon is much deeper truth than that. I was back in, I was in Romania in August, and I'd been ministering in one of the assemblies in Romania, and I happened to refer to the Song of Solomon, and at the end of the meeting, a lady came up to me, and she was a university lecturer from Moscow, and spoke excellent English, and she was a lecturer in literature. And she said to me, I was interested in what you said about the Song of Solomon. She said, I've always regarded it as just a literary work, you know, just simply talking about human love. So I was able to sort of sit alongside her and discuss the song with her, which she appreciated. Now, as far as I'm concerned, what we're going to be looking at, the standpoint we're looking at, is the Song of Solomon as illustrative of the relationship between Christ and the church and Christ and the individual believer. And that's the way we're going to look at it. Now, having said that, there are one or two things I want to make clear. As far as I'm concerned, there is but one lover in the song and one object of his affection. Now, I'll tell you why I'm saying that now, is because there are some writings which sort of introduce two lovers. One a king, Solomon, and one a shepherd. Now, when Harry Ironside wrote a little book on the Song of Solomon many years ago, he fell out quite strongly with that particular view, and the reason why he gave for it was simply this, that that particular approach to the Song of Solomon came from the wrong stable. It was originated by a man called Evald, and Evald was a critical writer, and Harry Ironside thought that it wasn't a view which he should follow because of the background from which it came. However, I think that there must be more reasons than that if I'm going to say that the view I take is that there's only one lover in the book, and I want to express why to you in a moment. But in fact, as far as I'm concerned, there's only one lover in the book and one object of love, and there's no rival and there's no disturbing influence on either side. And the one who the bride loves, she refers to in the book, throughout the book, as her beloved, he is indeed a king. So that she will speak of him as a king, whilst the king sits at this table, my spike not sends forth the smell thereof. So he's indeed a king. But he is also a shepherd. So she says to him, tell me where you feed your sheep. And these two figures come together. So occasionally she speaks of him as a shepherd, and other times she will speak of him as king. And when she speaks of him as shepherd, of course, she often speaks of him in a figurative way. Now, it seems to me that when two people are in love, they might address each other in all sorts of endearing terms. The imagination can run riot here, but I'm not going to embarrass any of you to offer some examples from your own past experience, but the fact of the matter is this, that when two people are in love, they tend to use pet names. I hope you haven't forgotten them all. And so more than one name is normally used. I see you're smiling. You obviously could remember this. Yeah. But so it's not unusual for someone like the bride to address her beloved in more than one name. Nothing unusual about that. Nothing at all. But there is something else, and it's more fundamental than that. When you come to the Bible, the roles of king and shepherd are intimately interwoven in the Bible and in the Old Testament. It's not that they are distinct and different, they are interwoven and connected. In fact, the shepherd-king role is one of the vital pictures which you have in the Old Testament. For instance, the shepherd of Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, turns out to be this king in Psalm 24, the King of Glory. And so the two pictures are involved together. So the sovereign of Psalm 23 is the King of Glory, the shepherd of Psalm 23 rather is the sovereign of Psalm 24. Then again, of course, when you look back at the Old Testament, many of the great men, the leaders of the Old Testament, were in fact shepherds. You take the case of Moses, who led 2 million people across the desert. Well, what was he doing before he led them? He was a shepherd, of course he was. And then, of course, in the Old Testament, and even more so, the play is made upon the relationship of king and shepherd in the history of David. You see, David was the first king after God's own heart. And the king that the people chose was Saul. And he was the keeper of asses, and he lost those too. But the king after God's own heart was David. And when you read about David, well, how do you read about him? Well, let's turn back to Psalm 78, shall we, and just see how God speaks of David in Psalm 78. Psalm 78, the last verse is verse 70. He chose David also his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the ewes, great with young, he brought him to feed Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So he chose David, says the psalmist, from shepherding sheep, to be king over Israel. But as king of Israel, he was acting as shepherd for God. So the two roles are put together. Now, turn over again just to make sure that we've got that picture again firmly in our minds, and let's read what the people said about that. And we're going to read now in the book of Chronicles, and we're going to read in 1 Chronicles chapter 11. 1 Chronicles chapter 11 is a verse similar to this in the book of Samuel, 2nd book of Samuel. 1 Chronicles 11 will do us better. And 1 Chronicles 11 and verse 2. Now this is when they recognize David as king. And this is what the people say to him, all Israel. We are bone of thy bone and flesh of thy flesh. They're saying that we are related to you. Moreover, in time past, even when Saul was king, thou wast he that leddest in and brought in Israel. And they're talking of leading out in battle and bringing back in victory. And the song of Israel in the day was Saul slayed his thousands, David is tens of thousands. And they're referring to that. And the Lord thy God said unto thee, thou shalt feed. And incidentally, the word feed there has the meaning of shepherd. You shall shepherd my, or rule in fact, my people Israel. And thou shalt be a ruler over my people Israel. You notice, feed and rule over, be ruler over. The same thing is given to us in similar words. Earlier in the second book of Samuel, chapter 5. So you've got this relationship brought together. The king was a shepherd, and the shepherd was a king. Now the supreme ruler of all, the sovereign of everything, is God himself. And the same figures are used of God. Now let's turn over to Isaiah in the next book, and we'll turn to chapter 40. Chapter 40, Isaiah. And we're reading in chapter 14, verse 10. Behold, the Lord God will come with strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. So he's the ruler, he's the sovereign. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. Now listen to what it says. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather his lambs with his arm, and shall carry them in his bosom, and shall gently lead those who are with young. And so you've got the combination of the ideas again. And when you come to the New Testament, you must remember that the same figure is given in the New Testament, and we are told in the New Testament that the one who was king of the Jews, and born king of the Jews, was also referred to himself as a good shepherd of the sheep. And the two things are together. You'll find in the book of Zechariah, again, that the true ruler, the true king, is the shepherd who is God's fellow. So that is that the fact that you've got these different terms doesn't mean that you're using two different characters. In actual fact, it's one and the same character, and the role is an interchangeable term. It's one role. The shepherd is the king, and the king is the shepherd. So it's not that there are two distinct personages here, and that's why I say that there's just one lover in this particular book. Now, the book itself is a long series of dialogues, and they're dialogues between bride and bridegroom, if you can use those particular terms. And in the course of these dialogues, what we find is the unfolding of the infinite love and undying love of the bridegroom. And secondly, we find also in that the growth and development of the bride. And now, ultimately, she is brought into the enjoyment of his love. And she's raised from her lowly position. She's a shepherdess and a keeper of vineyards. How she's raised from that lowly position to share the throne of the king himself. So we've got in this book the story of the love of an exalted bridegroom. He's a king. No, he's shepherd too. But we have in the book the story of the love of an exalted bridegroom for a bride of low degree, a keeper of vineyards, keeper of sheep. And together with that, we have the varied experiences through which he's brought into full relationship with him and into the full enjoyment of his love, which ultimately comes, finally, in the 8th chapter of the book, in the last canticle, the last song in the book. Now, it is possible in reading the book with a little bit of intuitiveness to try and construct the story on which this book dwells. And what I want to do is to try to bring that to you now and to point out where the clues are to what was happening. Let's just think for a moment about the book and see if we can put together the clues. Let's see if we can find seats for these brethren who are coming in now. We're looking at Song of Solomon chapter 1. Henry.
So, just to break here for a moment.
Hmm.
You're saying that you've got an exalted.
Bridegroom.
Right. An exalted king was the bridegroom.
Yeah.
Who focuses his love.
Yeah.
On a very lowly bride,
yeah,
or maiden.
Yes.
And the book, therefore, what you're going to bring before us tonight is the different experiences,
yes,
by which she of needs must be brought to her path to be brought to the place where she can interact with him in his reign and his exalted position.
Yes. In a sense, in this portrayal, you have, in the relationship which exists between Christ and ourselves, you put that way, you have an exalted bridegroom, and you have a bride of lowly status. So you've got this sort of connection. But we will be looking at this a little later in my comments, but you are right in saying that the book does portray the experiences through which she passes in that relationship. And we will look at that briefly tonight and see if I can just point out one or two things about that. Because that is important, because it does bring in the very practical point of our communion with Christ. Now let me see if I can put together something of the story behind it by putting together some of the bits in the book itself. And there may be variations on this, but let me just try and put it in this way. The bride, as I said, was someone of low status, low degree. And it seems that she came from the village of Shunem. Now, she is called later on a Shulamite. But the word Shulam is also sometimes portrayed as Sullam. And so it is suggested that she comes from the village of Sullam, or Shunem, which was at the gateway of the Halal Valley. Of the Hula Valley, rather. Now, if you read the book, there is no mention of her father. But as you read the book, we do read of a mother. If you look down in chapter 1 and verse 6, she refers to my mother's children. And so she will refer to her mother later on in the book. She talks about bringing her bridegroom into the house of her mother, of she that conceived me, she said. And so she has a mother. A mother is mentioned on a few occasions. And she also has brothers, by the look of it. Because in verse 6, she talks about her mother's children. So she had brothers. And chapter 8 will, in one particular part, refer to her brothers as well. So she has brothers. And they sort of pressed her into caring for the family vineyard. Because you notice what it said in verse 6, they made me keeper of the vineyards. She had her own vineyard, but because of being pressed into keeping the family vineyard, she was unable to look after her own. A part of keeping the family vineyard was that she had to chase away the jackals who came into the vineyard, and reference is made to that by him later on in chapter 2, when he says in chapter 2, take us the little foxes, the foxes that spoil the vines, the jackals. So it must have been one of her functions. She knew what he was talking about when he said that. And she also had care of a flock, because when you look down in verse 8, he is responding to her. You will notice what he says is, I know not all thou fairest among women, so he is addressing her in that way. He says, he goes on to say, feed thy kids beside the shepherd's tent. So obviously, she had the care of a flock. It appears, too, that she was her mother's special favorite, and the references to her mother in the book seem to indicate that, and possibly arouse the jealousy of her brothers. And that's one of the reasons, perhaps, why they were angry with her in verse 6. Now, it would appear that she met the king not in the city, that is, in Jerusalem, but she met him on one of his itineraries up north. And it seems it was a case of love at first sight. And that is expressed in verse 2, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine. And right at the commencement of the book, you have this impression of love at first sight. Now, it could be that her brothers thought that this was presumptuous on her part, and they thought to get her occupied, keep her mind off the matter, and that might have been one of the reasons why they made her look after the family vineyard. But the king rightly assesses the situation, sees the problem. And what he does is he approaches her not as king, but he approaches her as shepherd. And in verse 7, you will notice that she speaks of him as shepherd. Tell me, O thou whom my soul loveth, where thou feedest, where thou makest thy flock to rest at noon. And it was something which created joy in her heart to realize that her royal suitor, in his elevated position, had come to where she was in a lowly role to prove his love to her. He became shepherd and came to look after perhaps the royal estates north. And both these roles are seen in the canticle of shepherd and king, as I've indicated. And they enjoy each other's company, because the first chapter and chapter 2, they're talking to each other, quite clearly the dialogue expresses how happy they are in each other's company. Notice, for instance, in verse 15, thou art fair, my love, thou art fair, thou hast dove's eyes. He is saying that, and she responds, behold, thou art fair, my beloved, yea, pleasant, our bed is green, and so on. And this sort of conversation goes on, quite obviously enjoying each other's company. First in the country, you'll notice, when he says, our bed is green. Remember, this is poetry. And he's talking of grass. The beams of our house are cedar, our rafters are fir. And he's talking of the tree branches above them. They're in the country, you see. But then, of course, they're also in, later, they express their enjoyment of each other's company in the house of wine. And so you find in verse 4 of chapter 2, he brought me into the banqueting house. Literally, he brought me into the house of wine. And so you come to the end of chapter 2, and at the end of chapter 2, you will notice what it says, verse 7, at the end of Canticle 1, and it's in the middle of chapter 2, verse 7, I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, ye stir not, nor awake. And then it says, my love, and you notice the my is in italics, so it says, awake love, till he please. And translators here have had considerable difficulty in expressing what really was there. And so you'll get translations which read something like this. I charge you, ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose of the and the hinds of the field, that he stir not up nor awake love till it pleases. But in actual fact, the pronoun is feminine. And it's until she please. And so it is the bridegroom who is saying, I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up nor awaken my love till she please. And you will find that particular translation, if you have a Newbery Bible, in the margin of the Newbery Bible. Well, That comes to the end of Canticle 1. And so there she is, at the end of Canticle 1, enjoying the embrace of her beloved. You notice it says so in verse 6. And she's at rest in her enjoyment of his love. But then, winter follows. Now, I tell you how I know winter follows, is because when you go into Canticle 2, he has come back to meet her, and in Canticle 2, he says to her in verse 11, the winter is past. So it appears that when winter came, her love for him sort of cooled, and there was a cooling off period. But now spring has come, and that's what he is saying in verse 11, 12, 13. Winter's past, the flowers appear on the earth, time of singing of birds has come, and so on. It's now spring. And so he's gone back to her house, and he's speaking to her, and he wants her to join him. And in fact, from that particular verse down, right down to verse 5 of chapter 3, he appeals to her. She doesn't respond. Ultimately, she gets up and goes out to seek him, doesn't find him in the first instance, and then finally does. And chapter 3, verse 5, ends another canticle. And once more, she's at rest in the arms of her beloved. But then you come to the next passage, and that's chapter 3, verse 6. And if I can just summarize this, what you have here is a processional scene. And you have a palanquin, or a litter, which belongs to Solomon. And in these last verses, the second half of chapter 3, what has happened is Solomon has sent his litter down to the country where she is to bring her up to the city. And the verses down at the end of chapter 3 describe the provision he has made to bring her up. And then, of course, he comes and meets her in chapter 4 and tells her how lovely she is, and continues to do that right down into the end of chapter, towards the end of chapter 4. The end of chapter 4, she responds to him. He speaks of her as a garden enclosed. That means just simply for him. And she invites him into her garden. And you will notice that at the end in chapter 5, verse 1, chapter 4, verse 16, let my beloved come into his garden and eat his pleasant fruits. And he comes into his garden in chapter 5, verse 1, and he eats of the fruits which she has provided. So here's a passage in which there's been development, and she is actually providing fruit for him. There's been growth, and she's providing fruit for him. And that's the first time we read about that, actually, in the book. And so there we are, at the end of that canticle, and she's provided fruit for him, and he turns to the people around and says, eat, O friends, ye drink abundantly, O beloved ones. So he invites the others to have fellowship with him in the enjoyment of the fruit she has provided. And then you come to this word, verse 2, I sleep, but my heart waketh. And what, lo and behold, what's happened now is that having yielded fruit to him and sort of enjoyed the closeness of fellowship with him and being his garden enclosed and all the rest of it, and having heard all his words of how he appreciates her, lo and behold, she's back home in her house asleep, and he's outside knocking on the door asking admittance. Yeah. So that closeness is gone again, and there he is outside. And you get this picture of him knocking at the door and trying to get admittance, and no response. And ultimately, when she does get up rather late, tardily, to respond to him in verse 6 of chapter 5, he had gone. And she has to go and seek him in the city. And when she does so, she meets some characters who are called here in verse 8, the daughters of Jerusalem. Now, they appear again and again. They're like a little chorus which occurs throughout this book. They appear again and again, and just ought to say about them that they equate, I suppose, that's the easiest way to put it. They represent people who are interested in the beloved, in a sense. They want to know about him. And they are also able to appreciate what they see of him in her. So they say to her, the fairest, you're the fairest amongst women. So they see some of him reflected in her. And they want to know more about him. So there she is seeking him, and she comes to the altar of Jerusalem. She says, well, I charge you, daughter of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him that I am sick for love. And they say to her, all right, what are you creating such a fuss about? What is this beloved of you as more than any other beloved? You tell us. And you know, if you and I love Christ to such an extent, we'll get a query back when we tell people how much we love him. Now, what happened was, that was a challenge to her, and she began to think of how much he was to her. And she goes on to describe him. And there's this big, long, little passage, which is a very beautiful passage. My beloved is white and ruddy and so on. She needed no premeditation, done. She didn't have to think about it or prepare half an hour before the night before to say this. It came out. Her heart was full of him now. And it came out. And she ends by saying, well, listen, you know, he's so wonderful. He's so great. I cannot really describe him all. So I'm tired of talking about him, but I'll tell you this. He's altogether lovely. And he's the chief of unkempt house. Now, if you and I can speak of Christ like that, I'll tell you what the response will be. Because their response was, well, look, where's he gone? We want to know him too. Because that's what they say. Verse 1, chapter 6, whither is thy beloved gone? All thou fairest among women, where is he turned aside, that we may seek him with thee? We want to know him as well. Good would it be for us if we could so portray Christ that others would want to know him from what we have said concerning him. And then, of course, he suddenly appears. And chapter 6, verse 4, he speaks to her, and he's overwhelmed by his beauty, by her beauty, and you go right through into the next chapter, and in actual fact, the progress then is quite consistent. Sorry. The yes, I will go back over that. Yeah, I will, yes. Because I'm skipping through it now, but I will come back and show how the divisions come in. Yeah. And so at the end of it all, you will notice at the end of it, there is a plea for him to come back. And you notice what he says in verse 14. Make haste, she says, make haste, my beloved, be thou like to a royal young hart upon the mountains of Bisa. Now, let's have a look at how it develops, and Randy was asking about just now. There are two halves in the song, in actual fact, and the first half takes you up to 5:1, and then the second half of the song takes you from 5:2 to the end of the book. But this sometimes is called the canticles. That means songs. And in the book there are six canticles. And let me now indicate the divisions and where they occur. There is in the book what we might call a love question motif. That is to say, that you get the word love, wake not my love till she please, you get that. And you also get a question which occurs again and again. And this love and question motif actually indicates the commencement or end of a canticle. So now, chapter 1, right down through chapter 1 into chapter 2, and the first canticle ends with this statement. Verse 7, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that you stir not up nor awake my love till she please. So that's the first canticle. And what I would say about that is that that is concerned, well, if I was to put a heading to that, I would put a heading, Love Awakened. That's what I'd put over that. Because this is where her love is awakened, and it ends with her at rest in her beloved. Now, you notice... Sorry, yes.
Chapter 1, verse 1, 3, 2,
7. Right through to chapter 2 and verse 7. Now, notice, incidentally, notice the ending of chapter 2 and verse 7. I said it was the love question motif, and notice what it says, that you still not awake my love, my love till she please. So that's the love motif, you see, my love till she please, right? Now, the second canticle starts in verse 8. She hears his voice. She's in her home. She's resting there, and winter has passed, and the spring has come, and he's come down to seek her, and he comes knocking at her door. And she doesn't respond to him at first, but then ultimately she does, and you come down from verse 8 of chapter 2 down to verse 5 of chapter 3. And you notice chapter 3 verse 5 ends with the same statement. Alright? So it indicates a similar ending. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, Easter, and no, wait, my love, Lucy, please. Well, that's the ending. It's the same ending. Now, that, then the next canticle starts with a question. Remember I said it was love, question, motif, and you get a question, sometimes ending, sometimes beginning the canticle. And so in verse 6 of chapter 3, you start off a new canticle, who is this that comes up out of the mountain, out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke? And that takes you right, or incidentally, that canticle 2 I'm talking about, I would put a heading over that, love appealed to, because he comes down knocking at her door, and at first she doesn't respond, but she does ultimately. But I would say that was love appealed to. Then we come now to the question, verse 6, which starts the third canticle, and that takes you right down to chapter 5, verse 1. Chapter 5, verse 1. And that's the end of that particular canticle. Now, what happens in this canticle, and I'm going to summarize it up by just saying that that canticle could be put under the heading Love Adorned. Because what he does in verse in chapter 4 is he talks of her of her beauty, and he goes away in verse 6 to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense and comes back with the perfumes to place upon her in the remaining verses. So I say that that's Love Adorned. We will look at these things in detail, of course, when we come to it. Chapter 5 and verse 2 starts the next canticle, I sleep, but my heart awaketh. And it goes right on to chapter 6 and verse 10, and it ends with a question. You've got the question motif coming in. Who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun? And basically, the main theme of this one is love asleep, because she's asleep again in her latticed home. Chapter 6, verse 11, commences the next canticle, and it ends in verse 4 of chapter 8. And you will notice the ending in chapter 4, in chapter 8, verse 4. It's the same ending as the first two canticles, alright? Signals the ending of Canticle 5. And actually, there, she's consistently with her bridegroom, so I would call that love abiding. That's basically what she's doing, love abiding. The bride is submissive to his will. There's a little picture there in verse 12 of chapter 6, which we'll look at when we come to it. Whatever I was wearing, my soul made me like the chariot of Aminadab, and really the picture is of one who is submissive to the charioteer's will. And so our love is abiding there. Last of all, verse 5 of chapter 8, it's a very small canticle. Verse 5 of chapter 8, to the end of the chapter, is the last canticle, Canticle 6. I call this love atoning because there's a lovely little section in it, in verse 6, which talks of love, strong as death, jealousy cruel as the grave, coals thereof as fire, most vehement flame. And she's talking about love and what it achieves. Many waters cannot quench love. And you're away there, aren't you, with the billows and the waves going over him, but his love not being quenched. All right. Now, I've gone over my time. Let me snatch a few. Do you mind if I snatch a few minutes just to finish this? This particular book describes the communion of the soul with God. And it starts, you will notice, with a fervent desire for the beloved himself. Verse 2, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for his love is better than wine. And it's the Lord himself that the soul...